Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. And I want to first thank Les Wise for introducing my guest. We were over at NAMM Show a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you got to go meet this guy. You got to check this guy out. This is really great, great stuff. So I met my guest, and it was interesting because as I was setting up the show this week, and I was telling some of my friends who was on, all these other people that I know knew him, and they're like, oh, that guy's great. He's awesome. So I want to welcome David Becker to the show. It's really an honor to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
Wait a minute. I got the wrong mic. There
okay,
we go.
There we go.
There we go.
My pleasure to be here.
And anyway, I want to go ahead and open up with the title song from his solo album, his recent album,
yeah.
The most recent one, The Lonely Road. I'll go ahead and play that first, and then we'll get into talking about, and you'll get an idea of what we're talking about here. Anyway, that's a pretty lengthy clip, but I wanted to show all the different, there's a lot of different things that he was doing in the clip, and there's a lot of different guitars in there. It's pretty a layer. How many guitars were on that track?
There is there's a high-strung acoustic guitar. There is an electric guitar playing the main theme, and then there's the melody guitar, which is the heritage I'm playing. I think that's it. I think there's three. And there's a piano as well doing the
bass. So the high-string guitar, was that a Martin?
No, it's not. It's actually, I don't know what kind that is. A friend of mine, Tom Lilly, who used to play bass in the DBT, he moved to Texas, but he was out here in Burbank. And he had a high-strung guitar that I actually used on another album on the Message to Attila record
mm-hmm.
that we'll talk about. And I just wanted to mess around. I don't even know. It's a no-name kind of acoustic guitar. It was Nashville tuning.
Sounds killer.
Yeah, well, you know, we recorded it in his little studio in Burbank in a tiny little booth, and then I mixed everything and added the other guitars in Minneapolis at a studio that's got a really nice SSL board. And the engineer out there, Eric, is great, and we've worked together on several projects, so we're comfortable with each other.
Oh, it sounds great. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. You had graduated from, was it Musicians
yeah,
Institute?
Yeah, it was GIT.
It was still GIT.
Just before it became MI. In fact, when I went there were no drummers. There was, and Scott Henderson was there at the time, and Frank Abali came a little bit after that. Another guy was a rock guy, I can't think of his name, but anyway, maybe it'll
probably was Howard still around?
Howard was there. Howard would come every couple of weeks. Tommy was there.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Ford just started teaching there. Pat Martino came my last couple of quarters, and it was great. You know, Steve Morse came and did his very first seminar there. I saw John Abercrombie and Ralph Towner do something. I saw Steve Lukather. It was just at the height of when Toto first had their first couple of hits, and he came out. He was like 22 or something and mm-hmm. did a thing. And it was a great environment. I'm glad I went there. And Ron Eshte, of course, was there. Jody Orio, who was very, very important to my development as a guitar player.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and then you ended up collaborating with him later.
I did, yeah. Joe and I did a record together in 2005. And, I mean, I've known Joe for a long time now, and he's a very special human being. But I always wanted to make a record with him. And the opportunity came about in my second record. I was with MCA Records, and I wanted to do a duo for just one track. And we ran into budget problems, and like we got, you know, overdue with getting the tapes in and the masters in, so I had to cancel the session. I felt terrible. I said, Joe, you know, I'm sorry, I've got to cancel our session for this record. He goes, don't worry about it, man. And now years passed, and I'm with a label in Germany, and my label had asked me, is there anybody you want to do a record with? And I said, I'd love to do one with Joe. So we did The Color of Sound, and after that was released, he had his stroke. So it's the very last thing he recorded, and it's I wrote a couple of tunes. We did some standards, but we really played eye to eye. He even says that, you know, and I felt very humbled, but also very privileged to be able to do it. And it's a great record. It's available on iTunes, and you can get it online. Definitely, if your guitar players, check it out, because it's definitely got a lot.
Right. No, I heard that. I was reading the bio that you had sent me, and it was acclaimed as one of the best duo.
Yeah,
guitar albums ever.
We got some nice accolades from a lot of different jazz journalists. And, you know, basically for me what it was is we spent 2 days in the studio and we just had a conversation musically about what we were, you know, our relationship. And we never spoke about anything really. We would try different things out. And it wasn't just two guys playing standards that I didn't want to do that. I mean, we did play standards. We have a really interesting version of Stella by Starlight. And I'll tell you a funny story. We were talking about Richard Smith, who's the head of USC mm-hmm. Studio Jazz Guitar Department, where you went years ago. And he came in the studio. I invited him down with a guitar player from Italy. And Joe and I were in the middle of doing that version of Stella, and I didn't know they were there. And when we finished, I looked up in the booth, and they were both jumping up and down and clapping. So I guess we did something good. So that was
cool. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your early influences and how you got to where you are musically.
Well, I grew up in a musical family. My parents don't play, but my mom's family had piano, and they all took piano lessons. And my oldest brother, Ed, plays piano, or did play piano. And so we had a piano in the house, and I was the youngest of three. So I always wanted to play the drums, and I got a drum every Christmas. And then my brother, Bruce, who's the middle brother, he got a guitar when he was 7. And so we would all noodle around. We could all kind of play chords and piano, and I could play little drums and whatever. We'd make music somehow. And then formally, I wanted to take drum lessons when I was 10, but I didn't have the discipline to do the rudiments and all that stuff. I took like 4 or 5 lessons a year.
Yeah, I remember those.
So the sticks were there, the practice pad was there, and at some point my brother took over and did that. And then he encouraged me to go take the trumpet up in junior high. And I did that for 3 years, and I got really good. I won a music award. I was the first chair trumpet player in the jazz band and stuff. And then rock and roll kicked in because I had, you know, all kinds of influences musically. My brother had Led Zeppelin 2 and 1 when it came out, and Jimi Hendrix, and I bought records like El Chicano's record and Louis Belson records mm-hmm. and all these different things. And we didn't think about a style. And one of the first records I remember as a kid was Edvard Grieg's Piano Concerto in A Minor. Was one of my favorite pieces. I sit in front
cool.
of the stereo with a Tinker toy and conduct. So anyway, I took the guitar up to play rock, but it didn't really work out for me as a voice. I heard Grant Green shortly thereafter, about a year after I started a guitar at 15, and I went, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was aware of a lot of the guitar players like Al Di Meola and those kind of fusion guys of the time, and Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour and all that, but it didn't really resonate with me. I for some reason, when I took the distortion off and I started to play, and then I heard Grant Green, I wanted to get an arch top. And once I got an arch top, I didn't look back. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I discovered Wes Montgomery and Miles Davis and all that was creeping in. Because on the trumpet, my junior high school teacher would talk to us about, you know, Charlie Parker and about Lester Young. And he told us a story about Goodbye Pork Pie Hat and Charlie and Bird and all that stuff. And we didn't know the nuts and bolts of what he was saying, but we kind of got a gist of it. So it really,
right.
You know.
But at your house now, what stuff did you... Obviously, there must have been a lot of music being played in your house.
There was, yeah. I'd come home from school when I was in junior high school. My brother would be sitting in the living room on his drums. He wouldn't say anything. He'd just look at me. I'd take my trumpet out, and we would jam for like 45 minutes or an hour, just playing all kinds of stuff. I'd play melodies. He'd play, you know, grooves, and we were just going to do that. And that continued over when I played guitar. Of course, we put bands together. We had sort of a rock band for a little while where I wrote some rock tunes, and we recorded something when I was 15, which actually sounds pretty good. I could do sort of a good blues impression. But then I wanted to do jazz stuff, and that's how it sort of became the David Becker Tribune, which is the mm-hmm. band that's been around for a long time, that I just wanted to write my own stuff and play with my brother and a bass player, and that's how it kind of...
Well, how did you gravitate towards jazz? In the early days,
well, I mean,
somebody must have exposed you. Besides,
yeah,
there's
a couple things we had, you know, because when my brother was taking drum lessons at the Music Stop in Canoga Park with Henry Belson, who was Louis's brother, and it was owned by Terry Gibbs and Mel Zelnick, who was a vibist and also a drummer with Benny Goodman. We had, you know, the drummers that you listened to learn were Louis Belson and Buddy Rich, and you know that genre.
Yeah.
So we had big band records there. And I remember looking at the credits, and even when I played trumpet, saw some of the names of the guitar players. And then when I took up guitar, it just sort of seeped over. Then, of course, the progressive jazz rock fusion stuff came in, and I went to see Tony Williams. I saw Billy Cobham. I saw the Dixie Dregs' first gig in L.A. Just a whole bunch of stuff like that, where it was more rock-oriented guitarists playing, but sort of, you know, expanded musical stuff. And that... picked my ear up and went, okay. But I didn't understand how to fit into that. Not until I heard, you know, Grant Green, and I understood. And then Miles Davis, of course, we got from our neighbor, and, you know, we knew the name. And we had a guy across the street. He had every record you could ever imagine. And he'd say, oh, you like that? You should check this out. You like that? Check this
mm-hmm,
out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great. So Art Blakey and the Messengers. Oh, you don't know that? Okay, check that. So when I was like 18, I was driving all over Southern California, and I was a student at GIT, and I'd go see, like, you know, Milt Jackson, and I would go see Mickey Roker, and I would go see Dave Liebman or whoever was in town, and sit at Carmelo's and all these places that don't exist anymore in Dante's, and I was the only kid in the audience, you know, drinking a Coke and then, you know, driving my parents' car, and then I'd go home at 2 in the morning. But I wanted to know. I wanted to hang out and catch what was going on, and I was collecting records. And around the time that I was at GIT, I discovered Wes, and then I met Joe, and I knew Joe knew Wes. So that was a good thing because he could talk about Wes Montgomery. He had something. When I saw him play, I went, I got to get to know this guy.
Mm-hmm.
There's something going on there. And then I discovered guys like Pat Metheny and John Scofield, who weren't really famous at the time, and listened to their stuff, liked it a lot. John Abercrombie, my brother bought that record, Timeless, when I was 16. So that was another thing, too, with Jack DeJohnette and Jan Hammer, because
mm-hmm.
his drum teacher said, here, check this out, man. And later on, I know John now. We've worked together, so it's funny. His teacher said, you think these guys are trying to make money? And my brother told him that story, and John's like, well, as a matter of fact, we were trying to make money, but, you know.
Right.
But whatever. You know, it's so all that stuff was around, and that's how we never really thought about musical styles. I mean, for a little while, I got to be a jazz head, and I sort of turned my back on the rock stuff. But then I opened up again and said, you know, I need to listen to everything because there's validity in every music. So.
Well, it's interesting that you started on trumpet. I mean, my first instrument was accordion, and
mm-hmm.
it's ruined me forever. No, I'm just kidding. But it was fun. But it definitely had an influence in certain things. I mean, I played keyboards too besides guitar, and it influenced the way I would arrange
right.
and stuff. But the trumpet. It had to have an influence in your phrasing.
Oh, it
stuff.
Did. Yeah, I still think like
because it makes you
yeah.
more unique
yeah.
because of that.
I can tell you two stories. I mean, I played piano, too, and I thought about playing piano and not guitar. But then when I picked up the guitar, I remember my junior high school teacher invited me to sit in with – he had a band of pros that would go read charts, you know, and I blew off a big band rehearsal at the high school to go sit in with him. And he came to me afterwards. He said, you know, David, when I heard you quit trumpet, I was disappointed. But he said, when I heard you play guitar, I knew why. And so, you know, that was a great compliment. And I just, the fact is that, yeah, I think like a trumpet player. I think more melodically. I don't think about scales. I think about shapes. I think about moving up the neck as opposed to moving in one position. And I still hear, I have what's called relative pitch. So I always hear a B flat in my head.
Right.
And that came from the trumpet. So, you know, that's...
Because a lot of guitarists, a lot of the jazz guys were influenced by saxophone.
Sure, sure.
The trumpet... It's a different way to phrase.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember I had a Dizzy Gillespie record when I was like 12 or 13, and I love Clifford Brown, and I love, you know, Lee Morgan and Miles, and there's something about that instrument that I like the sound of. So a lot of times when I'm playing the guitar, I kind of think trumpet, you know. I mean, there are a lot of guys who play guitar that were trumpet players. Matheny was a trumpet player.
Really?
Yeah, and Mark Egan played trumpet before he played bass, and several other guys I can't think of.
Do you still pick it up once in a while?
I did when I was living in L.A. before I moved over to Europe. I'm back in L.A. again. But I would pick up – I had a four-track, and I picked up a trumpet and a baritone horn, and I wrote some weird arrangement stuff because I was trying to experiment with – I could probably still do it. I did a gig a few years ago with a trumpet player, and I picked up his flugelhorn. My lips get swollen, but, I mean, if I practice, I could probably still play.
That's good. Yeah. You know, that's great that you still retain it. But now let's go into a little bit of into your guitar work. Let's talk a little bit about your style of guitar. Now, I noticed that on The Lonely Road, again, you had the high string Nashville tuning. And one of the things we were talking, which we're going to get into in a minute on, is the new signature model guitar, is you have the piezo pickup and the other, so that you have the acoustic guitar.
Right.
And you had mentioned that you, when you were recorded before, you would use an acoustic and electric.
Right. Well, I still use acoustic guitars in the studio. I mean, the way I got involved in this guitar becoming to fruition was that in my early part of my career, I was about 21, I met Chris Martin, who was C.F. Martin IV, the Martin Company. And he liked the way I played. The bass player that was in the DBT in the first inception is a good friend of his, and he wasn't the head of the company. He was just Chris, and they didn't really take him seriously, but he would show up to the NAMM shows, and he invited me to come and play. So I would sit at the Martin booth and play, not bluegrass or what you'd expect out of a guitar. I'd play like all this weird jazz stuff that I was working on, and they liked that. So I did that with him for a couple of years. I mean, we went on the road a lot. We went to Europe, and we went all over the States and did a bunch of clinics, and then I wound up in an ad for Martin Guitars with Steve Howe when I was 22.
Very cool.
Because he was an endorsee. They never used people in ads before, and the marketing guy, who's still a friend of mine, said, hey, we want to put you in an ad. I'm like, great. So because I was just, you know, we were playing and we were getting a reputation around town, and I was going to Europe a lot, and we had done a recording at Warner Brothers, and then we were putting a European tour together. So everything kind of fell in place at the same time because I had no aspiration to play the baked potato. I wanted to go to Europe and play jazz. I played it later on in my career, but it was like, it wasn't like the thing that I wanted to do. I wasn't interested in the LA kind of music that was being made. It didn't really resonate with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it still, to a large degree, doesn't. Not that something's wrong with it. I just liked more, I don't want to say the New York stuff or the European stuff. But
how was it different? How was the European different?
Well, the thing that I think is different is that there was just a different tilt. There were musicians that were playing with a lot of American guys that, if you would look at guys like Jan Garbarek and Eberhard Weber, and they were playing with guys like Gary Burton and John Abercrombie and whoever else, Ralph Towner, there was a whole group of guys going over to Europe, and not even just the ECM guys that everybody would know, but other guys that were recorded for other labels. There was just I think what it is because jazz is an American export, it went over to Europe, and the Europeans took it onto themselves and did something, like Joe Zawinul and Attila Zoller, the record that I produced. He was from Hungary, and they had their own take on it. I mean, they definitely did their homework, and they definitely could play. If you look at a lot of the clips of Wes Montgomery playing in Europe in the 60s, he's playing with a lot of European guys, Belgian, Dutch, and German.
Well, I know they took the jazz more seriously over there.
But they added their own little take to it, and I just kind of like that sort of thing. I think the thing about, you know, I'm not I don't want to diss anything that happened here in L.A., because there's some very important music and musicians, but what I was hearing was a lot of just jamming at loud volumes. There wasn't a lot of dynamics. It was like, we're going to go up to 50 and then stay there and then go down to zero, as opposed to having subtleties where, you know, I don't know, that's, it's maybe, you know, like Miles Davis. You know, Miles Davis didn't play bebop at one level. He played music that was, after he left Charlie Parker, he kind of developed his own thing. And if you listen to him, he didn't have the technique of Clifford Brown, but he had something very unique. And whatever that thing was, that X factor that he had, there was an X factor that I found in some of that music.
Well, in the European, can you, I don't know if you can demonstrate this, but in terms of like phrasing or technique, can you show what the difference is? Can you kind of give us an idea?
Well, it'd be hard to do that. I mean, the vocabulary is kind of the same, but, well, you know, if I was to play something, you know.
I mean, how would it be done like in America, like L.A., and then, I mean,
well,
can that be defined?
Here's the thing. The L.A. thing was more about, there were a lot of guys that just wanted to turn up and play loud and play more jam stuff that was, I don't want to say rock-oriented, but was more funk-oriented. Not to, because, I mean, there's bands like Spyro Gyra, and I know those guys. I've toured with them as an opener, and, you know, their stuff was like kind of the model of what the LA guys were trying to do, because they, and they're from New York. So I think it's more of a question of just the musical nuts and bolts of the tunes.
Because I mean, like people like Billy Cobham, who plays a lot in Europe,
right.
They were doing a lot of rhythmic things
they
that were pretty complex.
Yeah, they were.
But I don't know if that was prevalent in Europe.
It was to a certain degree, but there were other things that were more subtle, you know. If you watch concerts from like Eberhard Weber, you know, he was doing stuff in the 70s with his band Colors, which had an interesting thing. Charlie Mariano, a sax player from the States, he played in Stan Kenton's band. He knew my junior high school teacher. And then he had a blues drummer from England, John Marshall. And then he had this really incredible classical jazz pianist from Cologne, Rainer Brüninghaus. So the mixture, I think, is what it was. And our first gig that we had in L.A. that was the main gig for us, we played a place in Venice called the Comeback Inn. It was owned by a German, and we weren't allowed to play covers. Once in a while, we'd sneak in a standard, but it was great. He encouraged us to do our own stuff. So I think that was kind of like, you know, a breeding ground for that. It was kind of like a little Europe or a little some oasis that wasn't the typical kind of place. And we did get an audience after. We did it a year. We were there like once or twice a month.
Was there you were in Germany, right?
Well, this was first here, yeah. I went to Germany when I was very young to check out the record scene, and I knew there were labels that would be interested in what I was doing as opposed to here.
But when you moved to Europe, where did you live?
Well, the first time I went to Europe, I was 19 or 20, and I would kind of pedal around and try to find labels. I moved to Europe officially after we had all the records out here in the early 90s, and I was in Belgium for a while, then in Vienna for a bit, and then Germany. But the thing for me was is that the European thing in the beginning was I was looking for a small boutique label, and I thought, you know, and I had guys that were interested in what I was doing, and I almost got a record deal, but for some reason we went and toured Europe first when I was 22, and we had a very successful tour, and then we did the States and colleges and all over the place, and we had this EP that wasn't released through Warner Brothers, and then I got a record deal with MCA, which is something I never imagined in my wildest dreams to get. I was like totally against getting a major label, but it just happened to happen at the time that they put together a jazz division that put the Impulse stuff out. And the guy that headed up the label, Ricky Schultz, was an interesting guy. He knew a lot about jazz. He'd worked jazz at Warner Brothers. And he saw what I was doing, and he said, yeah. So that's.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What was the difference in the scenes from Belgium, Germany, and where was the other place?
The Netherlands, or, you know, France.
Was there a different, I mean, there must
there is a little bit. I mean, if you go to Amsterdam, there are a lot of bebop guys that, you know, the Dutch are very good at playing bebop. There's swing. I mean, you go to, there's festivals that just do like Dixieland swing. Now it's kind of like a, you know, it's a hybrid of everything pretty much. But when I first got over there, the interesting thing was is that, you know, we were billed as a the West Coast, you know, modern jazz trio, and we played this club in Berlin when I was 22 in 84, and it was packed. You know, people came and they wanted to see these young, you know, musicians from California. And it wasn't billed as California jazz, it was more like modern jazz, whatever it was that we did. And they were a great audience. I mean, that's the thing about the Europeans. They listen very, very intensely to the music.
Yeah, I remember that was, because a lot of the people I know that were playing jazz. Even Rittenhour had mentioned that, that they really, you're more appreciated over there.
You can hear a pin drop. I mean, I don't, I audiences here do appreciate it as well. I've played lots of places over the years in the States, and we've had, you know, pockets over the years. We used to tour relentlessly in a van. We did over 100,000 miles, every city, every state you can imagine. You know, different big theaters, small clubs, whatever, lunchrooms, and all these different things. And that, for the most part, people were into listening. I think the thing is that because jazz is an American cultural export, it's looked at a little differently in other parts of the world. Just that's how it is.
You know? Right.
Just like blues was to the English. They were like, they got into the blues thing and nobody cared about blues here. And then they came over and the resurgence.
Rediscovered
it. Yeah, exactly.
Now, I'm going to, we're going to talk a little bit about your technique in a minute, but I want to play a piece that'll kind of set it up. And I want you to set up this piece because there's a story to this. We're going to play this clip called Thousand Dreams.
Right. This is actually from the album last year that I produced. It's a tribute to the guitarist Attila Zoller, who passed away in 1998. He was from Hungary, and he made his way to Germany and Austria and then on to New York, and he played with everybody. Herbie Hancock is on one of his records on a tune called The Birds and the Bees. He was Pat Metheny's only teacher. When Pat was like 15, he met him at a jazz camp, and Attila took him under his wing and invited him to New York to hang out with Jim Hall and Ron Carter. Wow. So I put together a tribute record for Attila. I was asked to do that. And Pat's on it, Jim Hall's on it, Ron Carter, John Abercrombie, Mike Stern, a bunch of guys. And this track is one with Ron Carter and myself and guitarist Gene Bernicini, who's also good friends with, he's a New York player, with Attila, and my brother Bruce on drums.
Okay, let's play. This is Thousand Dreams. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Now, let me, before I get into technique and stuff, I got to know what everybody was using. What were you using and what was Gene using?
Okay, I was playing the Heritage, my model, and he was playing a nylon string. Of course, Ron's using his bass, and my brother was playing DW drums. And it was in a studio in New York, which was very long and very thin, narrow. So Ron was to my left in the booth, the bass booth. I could see him there. Gene, poor Gene, was in the corner with a baffle, playing with headphones on, and the drums were so loud that I remember having the cans on, thinking, "Man, this is a terrible mix." But it came out great. But we ended up using Gene's pickup, and not his acoustic sound, and it sounds great because he has a really nice pickup on there. I'm not sure what he has on there.
Because it sounds acoustic, and then some of it, the way he's playing, it sounds electric.
Right,
and it was
right.
Hard to. It was an interesting tonality.
Yeah, and there's a duo that I captured also of Gene and Ron Carter doing a ballad of Attila's. It's just beautiful. It was one of those things where I said, hey, guys, just do this. Go do that. And because I had to produce and play and stuff. I didn't play on the whole record. I just played on a few cuts. But it was a great experience to work with Ron Carter. He's a really great gentleman, and we've become friends from the project. And I never thought in my wildest dreams that I'd work with Ron Carter. So
that's amazing. That's great. Now, let's talk a little bit about your playing then and your approach to playing. Because you do a few different things. Mm-hmm. You do the single note thing, and Your tone is killer.
Oh, thank you.
And actually, really quick, too, what amp were you using those?
Oh, in that session? Man, I don't remember what that was. On the Lonely Road, everything was direct for the electric guitars.
Wow.
I used no amps. And I do that. I always go direct anyway, and then I use an amp. I think in New York, it was a weird amp. I don't remember what it was. It was in the hallway somewhere.
It wasn't a Fender or...
No, it was... I don't remember exactly. It's one of those weird boutique amps, but I couldn't tell you.
Because the tone is... I mean, your tone's really consistent, but it has an interesting color to it.
Well, the thing on that record, you know, I wanted to use more of the direct sound, because this guitar mm-hmm. sounds great direct. So I'd probably... If I don't remember when we mixed, because we mixed this one and two in Minneapolis, and I don't remember exactly, but I'm sure we used more of the direct sound than the amp.
So you do single picking, mm-hmm. and then you also your fingers,
sure.
too.
Yeah, I do finger stuff. I mean, the finger stuff for me is just, you know, I kind of developed a technique for my... picking using my nails, and I remember seeing Ralph Towner years ago talk about that he learned this technique from Carl Scheidt, who's a famous Austrian classical player, where you push down on the string and then, mm-hmm. and then as it lifts up the nail kind of hits it, as opposed to clawing it. I don't do that exactly the way he does, but I've noticed that's kind of what I do. I kind of push down on it and then the nail catches it as it goes up.
Now, you have nails like a classical guitar player.
Yep. And I didn't use them in the very, very beginning of playing guitar. I didn't have nails, and I used to play with just my fingertips. And I had a problem with my fingers was a little bit cumbersome. And then it developed over the years. It just somehow, and as it developed, I realized how important the nail is. So,
you get a really mellow sound? You don't get the nail sound like a...
No, I don't. And I mean, I can if I put the piezo on, I might get a little bit more of that sound if I just, you know. But actually, no, because I think what's happening is just the nail is kind of...
Is it all nail or are you using some of the flesh?
A little bit of the flesh. It's both. You know, I mean, if it's a darker tone, you know, it's that it. I guess it's just over the years it's developed into its whatever it is.
Well, let's stop for a minute and talk about this guitar that was made for you from Heritage. This is a prototype that you brought
in. This is the prototype. This is what we call the Million Miler because she and I have flown and traveled over almost 1.5 miles all over the world. And now it's a signature model. It was released actually a year ago at NAMM. It's called the David Becker 575 signature model. You can order one. And it's basically just like the prototype. What it is, it's a solid spruce top carved. It's maple sides and back. It's 3 inches deep, whereas the 575 standard model from Heritage is 2.75. It's got a regular scale neck like the 575 has. But the difference for me is that I had the piezo put in the bridge, and there's a humbucker. And in this guitar, when I got it from them originally, they didn't have Seymour Duncan pickups. They had something else. But I know Seymour, and I took this up to him when I got it. And he pulled something out of his drawer and said, put this in here. So now the pickups that are in the standard David Becker model are Seymour Jazz pickups, which are kind of like...
Did they model it from that one?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he's got several that he made years ago, and I think they kind of came up with the best of that. I kind of am... I played at the NAMM show of the new David Becker this year. I played that guitar, and it's very close to mine. I didn't find it to be very different at all. And I played one the year before, so they're pretty consistent. So, and that's, you know, the reason I had the piezo put in, because I wanted to have the ability to have the acoustic guitar as well. And like I said, I fly a lot.
So he, instead of a three-way switch, he has two toggles.
It's just on and off switches.
For both pickups.
And I actually, the reason I came up with this, other than just having the need for the acoustic and electric, was I was in Germany just before I got this guitar, and I went to the Hofner factory and met the people. I had lunch with them. And they had a guitar that had a piezo and a humbucker, but they had a toggle switch that you could go back and forth. So the middle position was... both. But they only had a tone and a volume, one. And I said, I'd like to do that, but I'd like to have where I can switch it on and off and have separate tone and volume controls.
Right. It makes sense. It gives you more versatility.
Yeah.
But are the tone and volume, the values different for the different pickups?
Yeah.
The,
I mean, because humbuckers generally on archtop guitars don't really kick in till about 7 or 8, you know. So if I was to put, you know, and you're hearing it acoustically too over the mic. It sounds great acoustically. This is total, let's see, I'll turn everything off. That's just acoustic.
Yeah, it's a pretty live guitar.
Very live. So if I put both pickups in, now I can add more of the humbucker. And I take it off. You know, that's a little bit more of the piezo. Plus I can play behind the bridge and do some interesting things.
That's cool.
Which I'll do. So, yeah, I've learned to use this thing. And that's the thing. I'm glad now that it took 28 years to become a signature model, because I've had that much experience on the road with it to really tell people, hey, this is what it can do. You know, it's not just a vanity guitar like, hey, I've got my name on a guitar. No, it's a workhorse. And for guys who play jazz, who want to be able to play a jazz sound, but also get other kinds of sounds and not have to, you know, because I always thought that the bridge pickup on an archtop was kind of useless. It really didn't do much. It really doesn't sound good to me.
I mean, like a regular humbucker?
Yeah, like on a 175 and stuff. I had one and I never used it.
That's true. Most of the jazz players use the rhythm pickup.
You could use both. I mean, Joe used to use both pickups. But
now, is that bridge, the piezo bridge, is that locked down or is that move around?
You can actually move it. It's adjustable, but it's locked when the strings are on it. So yeah, it's not stuck.
It doesn't move. I mean, I've had that problem with like my Gretsch.
No, I don't. I have not had that problem. The intonation on this thing is very good, and I've been very lucky that it doesn't move. And with all the different climates I go to, sometimes I go from South America to Asia or to, you know.
I'm gonna take a picture of that piezo so we can show it up online. It's an interesting. Who makes the piezo? Is that just from Heritage?
No, this one was made by a different guy, but the one they have now is Bags. They have a Bags piezo.
Oh, okay.
So that's the one they're using. You can get all the literature. In fact, if you go to my website, there'll be a link to, or there'll be some information about the guitar.
Oh, okay.
So
it's interesting because the wood, and I'll post the pictures up of it, the wood is just beautiful. And the finish, talk a little bit about this finish, because you were telling me a little bit that... this finish was developed by the...
Yeah, by Marv Lamb, who was one of the owners of Heritage. He's an old Gibson guy, just like they all were. And when I went to the factory in 1988, I had sort of set my sights on getting a guitar finished close to what my 175 looked like, which was sort of cherry sunburst. And he had just come up with this. It's called Almond Sunburst. And he said to me, hey, and he's from the South, he said, hey, you think you want to get that, you know, that finish? And I said, well, we were just leaving. I said, you know what? Yeah, okay, and I'm glad I did, because it was because I said, nah, you know, he had suggested in the beginning, I was like, no, I kind of want this, and then when he said that again, I went, okay, and they did a superb job on this one.
The finish alone, it's beautiful, but it's not a real gaudy guitar or fancy guitar.
No.
I mean,
no,
he's got a very simple, the fretboard dot inlays,
right.
No binding, it's a very simple binding on the guitar.
Exactly.
It's beautiful. And you have, I think those are Grovers, right?
These are, I believe, yes. I think they, yeah, those are Grovers, and I think they're still using them. I'm not sure. I should know, but the thing is I wanted a guitar that wasn't, you know, gaudy. I just wanted a simple workhorse, because it's what it is for me. It's an instrument that you play, and Some guys get all this pearl inlay, and that's nice if you want to have that, but I just wanted a very simple-looking instrument.
Well, it's interesting. You had said that you used, in some of the recordings, early recordings, you were using a 175 and a Martin, and it seems that this guitar approximates that
pretty
well.
Yeah, it does. It does. That was the I guess that was the desire at the time to kind of combine, because like I said, I fly a lot, and taking two guitars is impossible. I can ask the promoter to get me an acoustic, and sometimes they do, and sometimes it's horrendous, and the strings are like that.
Right.
You never know what you're going to get. So,
what kind of strings are you using?
I use Dean Markley Blue Steels. I've been an endorsee with them for, I think, close to 27 years, 28 years. And the Blue Steels I love because they're very consistent, and they stay. They're round wounds. And it's a hybrid set. I use the Jazz set, which is a 12 and 16 for the E and B string. And then this is what's called the medium for the E, A, and G, D. It's a 52. The G string is a wound 20. And I actually have to get those sent separately because they don't put them in the sets anymore. Mm-hmm. They have the 18s, which are the unwounds. But Dean Mark has been great, and they supply me the strings. And I've
What's
been
the
happy.
D and the A?
The D and the A is, let me think, this is a 52. I think this is a 42. And this, I believe, is a 30. Okay. I think so. 30 or 32. I'd have to look at the string pack. But if you get the 11 sets, which is called the medium blue steel electrics, that's what they'll be. But just all I do is I change out the top strings. I like a little more resistance for the, for that
and
string.
And it gives you, the round one gives you enough of the overtones when you're using the P8, so
exactly.
It gives you the acoustic sound.
Right, and it's funny because Joe DiOrio used round wounds for years, and when I first got an arch top, I got half wounds and tried those for a while. And then I remember talking to somebody about it, and eventually a lot of guys started using round wounds. Matheny uses round wounds now. He's been using those for a while. He used to use flat wounds. It's just, I think it feels more like an acoustic guitar, and you get a little more meat on the pick and fingers and stuff when you play. Of course, with flat wounds, you can do the West and slide around and stuff like that, but I never really liked the feel of flat wounds, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I found these guys. I had been using GHS strings, and a guy that I knew was a rep for them at Dean Markley and was chasing after me and said, hey, you got to try these, and they came up with the Blue Steels, and I went, yes. So they've been with me forever.
Now, with using the on your recordings, I know this is your primary guitar, and you mm-hmm. use it for everything.
Right.
But do you use other guitars for your recordings?
Once in a while, I have an interesting Martin electric. It's called an E28. It was designed by a guy from Martin, John Marshall, who's a very good friend of Bonnie Raitt's, and I met Bonnie through him. And it's just a one-piece neck and body,
mm-hmm.
and it has, I think they're DiMarzio pickups. It's a very unique sounding guitar. I use it occasionally on recordings. I used to take it on the road when we would travel in a van, but it's just it's too cumbersome.
No, but I mean, what else do you have in your collection?
Not a lot. I don't have a lot of guitars. I used to have lots of them, but I just got rid of them. I have two of these. They made me another one a couple of years ago at David Becker, and then I have the.
They're pretty consistent.
Yeah, the new one isn't quite as. They were getting to the point where they were going to launch the signature model, so they were experimenting, and they had lost the plans because they had a fire in the plant, and I'd sent everything per email, and they're kind of old school, so they lost some of the stuff. So they did a few things a little differently, like the tailpiece is wrong, but they sent me a new one. But it's pretty consistent. I mean, the ones they made now for the actual David Beckers that you can buy, they're very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
They did a great job on those.
And so if you interchange between, if you're playing, they're virtually identical.
The one that I had the NAMM show, I mean, I played that for the first couple of days, and then I brought the Million Miler for the last day. Obviously this has a little bit more, worked in, but,
Do you still have a Martin acoustic?
I have a Martin acoustic, and I had a 12-string, but I got rid of it because I just never used it. I on the recording with Joe DiOrio, we did a tune where I had it 9 strings on it, and we did an interesting tune, or a couple interesting tunes with that.
Do you remember what Martin you have?
The Martin that I have is called an MC68. They don't make it anymore. It's got the oval sound hole, and I never play it. So.
Okay, but was that what you used in your earlier recordings?
Yeah, in the earlier recordings, it was the Martin MC-68 on a lot of the first actually maybe 12 records. I think I used that one on that. And because now I record in different cities and different countries and fly a lot of times whatever the studio has.
Now, when you when you're playing live now, what do you record direct most of the time? Mm-hmm. But when you're playing live, what do you use?
Well, whatever they get me. I mean, I ask for Fenders or PVs or something. I prefer solid state. And I did a festival in Indonesia. They actually had a Marshall and a Roland jazz chorus.
How did that work?
It actually worked out okay. It still sounded like me. I can work with anything. And you know, it's like I bring a couple of pedals with me, and I know how to plug in and kind of EQ things. And it's, you know, the sound is in your fingers more than it is in the amp. So
what pedals do you use?
I have a Roland digital delay. It's a DD7. Just for some slap. So you can, you know, I don't like reverb. Reverb's okay in the studio, but I like a little slap because it kind of works like reverb, but it doesn't really kind of sound like a cave.
Right.
And then I have a Ditto loop pedal, which I use a lot for the solo stuff that I do. So.
Well, why don't you just give us a quick little demo? I know we're
sure.
Almost out of time, but.
Yep.
Using the because he was playing around with it before the show when he was warming up, and it was really cool.
Yeah, I'm going to take the cans off here. So
okay, go ahead.
Bear with me.
He was layering and doing. He was altering the guitar, putting a piece of paper. And I tried to grab some pictures while he was doing because he's moving really fast.
Yeah, it's
was brilliant.
It's a card that I got from a copy shop in Germany, around the corner from where I used to live. And this one's a little beat up. I have a new one that I've got to change it out. And it just it gives that sitar and drum sound and just some experimentation that I did. And you know, there you go.
Well, I told you it would go by really fast. We're already out of time. I want everybody to know www.davidbeckertribune.com and David Becker Tribune on Facebook, too.
Right. There's also a David Becker page on Facebook. I've got so many friend requests, it's like 800, that it's hard for me to add people. But if you do come and you want to connect with me on Facebook, go to the David Becker Tribune like that. You can send me a message, and I do check that. And on the webpage, there's you can go to the Facebook and to the YouTube and all this stuff is all connected. So
yeah, and we have the Color of Sound that he did with Joe DiOrio, The Lonely Road,
that's the latest record, yeah.
And then what was the...
The Message to Attila, that's a record that's on Enja Records, and that's also available on iTunes and all the various places.
Okay, and then what's coming up for you?
I'm toying with a live record. There's a talk about a tour down in New Zealand and Australia, so I'm thinking about... Because the trio hasn't done a live record yet, so, mm-hmm. I mean live with an audience, so that's probably the next
thing. That'd be very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Obviously, we're going to have you come on again. And actually, maybe we might just actually, we could do maybe an acoustic thing and have the trio come on.
That'd be great.
And talk
sure.
about the interaction
Absolutely.
Of the band.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave with My Foolish Heart from The Lonely Road. Anything you want to mention about that?
Just a tune that I really liked. And I actually did a version for a student of mine who asked me to do that. And I just thought I'll record it for the record. So, and I'm using the piezo and the humbucker on this one.
Okay, so that's really good. So this is called My Foolish Heart. Everybody have a great week, and we will see you next week. And thanks again. I really appreciate having you come down.
My pleasure, Jeff.
And
thank
a special thanks to Les for introducing me to you.
Yes.
And Heritage Guitars, they're killer guitars. This is a great, I love this guitar. Everybody have a great night. We will see you next week.